Up Against the Wall, Colin wrote at La Tourette by Anthony Vidler from Log, Winter Spring 2012. So it opens with a couple of quotes. In the winter of 1961, or like a preface, let's say. In the winter of 1961 and during three consecutive supervisions in his almost modern lodgings in Fen Causeway, Cambridge, England, I witnessed Colin Rowe writing his article on Le Corbusier's Monastery of La Tourette, commissioned by the Architectural Review. Laboriously typing and retyping on his characteristic yellow paper, Rowe evinced considerable anguish, if not boredom, at having to, as he put it, look for so long at a single building. The supervisions were taken up with discussions of his developing text, especially with how to characterize the apparently blank side wall of the church, which, quote, perversely offered itself to the view of the approaching visitor. I remember I offered two lame suggestions. One, that the twisting light cones might be thought of as the hands of a saint in the agony of martyrdom, and the other regarding the false perspective, the quote, false perspective of the pattern of converging lines left by the concrete framework. And then a quote from Mathematics of the Ideal Villa by Rowe. A criticism which begins with approximate configurations and which then proceeds to identify differences, which seeks to establish how the same general motif can be transformed according to the logic or the compulsion of a specific analytical or stylistic strategies, is presumably Wolffian in origin, and its limitations should be obvious. Since the late 1960s, architectural criticism, where it has not fallen into the conventional realms of functionalism, formalism, or social realism, has been deeply divided between a mode derived from one or other of many structuralisms and post-structuralisms and a supportive role for an architectural tendency. The divided nature of criticism was further exacerbated by Manfredo Tarfieri's insistence that all forms of interpretation and ideological alliance should be screened out of the business of writing history, properly speaking. In the process, a form of critique that emerges out of a close examination of the building itself and provides at once an experimental analysis and a way of viewing the object that situates the reader spatially and intellectually has been lost. That peculiar mixture of observation and propositional interpretation with historical and theoretical reference, characteristic of much writing in the 1950s and 60s and practiced by writers as diverse as Rowe, Rainer Banham, Robert Maxwell, Alan Colquhoun, and Kenneth Frampton. Among these, the first and debatedly the most influential was Rowe, whose articles in the Architectural Review beginning in 1947 could be said to have established an entirely new genre of architectural criticism, one that it might be salutary to review today in the wake of the rise and fall of the neo-critical theory of the 70s and 80s. Architectural criticism, as distinct from history and theory, has always been somewhat of a hybrid, caught, as Erwin Panofsky noted, between the narrative description of the object in context and the value judgments associated with a building's status as an aesthetic object. Vasari mixed biographical anecdote with sharp critical observations to produce a ranked list of Renaissance architects that set the roster for several centuries. Johann Winckelmann tried joining a historical style schema of development in three stages, birth, maturity, and decay, to an absolutist belief in the virtues of the, quote, high Greek period that condemned everything after Pericles to a slow decline. John Ruskin was so devoted to the idea of the Gothic, whether Byzantine, Romanesque, or the three periods of his Gothic, that the Renaissance was no more than an unhappy end to art. Wolfflin's Renaissance was contrasted with a Baroque that led to the disseminated figures of modernity. Geoffrey Scott's Renaissance outshone all previous eras of his, quote, humanism. Freighted with the style wars of the 19th century, modernist architectural criticism attempted to remove itself from aesthetic opinion through the lenses of abstraction, the formal method of Wolfflin, without his pathology of decadence, and scientific observation, the psychology of perception and experience. Post-war Britain inherited all of these modes, some embedded in the connoisseurial tradition inherited from the 18th century and still active in the articles of country life, and in a more scholarly vein in the Courtauld Institute with Anthony Blunt, some derived from the formal painterly criticism of Roger Fry and the psychological interpretation of Adrian Stokes, and some animated by the Marxist readings of Francis Klingender and Herbert Reid. This landscape was, however, quickly transformed by the arrival of the German scholars in exile, notably Rudolf Witkauer and Nicholas Pevsner. Witkauer's influence was exercised through the equally recent transplant of the Warburg Institute from 1934 to 56, before his departure for Columbia University. Pevsner's was long-lasting, first in his editorship of the Architectural Review and then in the apparently inexhaustible series of The Buildings of England, as he opportunistically translated his earlier Germanophilia into Anglophilia. It was Pevsner's liberal attitude to widely different modes of critique that characterised the review in the early post-war years. While he preferred to concentrate on purely historical essays that brought little-known or forgotten architects into the canon, he supported, together with his co-editors Hubert de Cronin Hastings, J.M. Richards and Gordon Gullen, the development of the visual approaches associated with townscape, the theoretical approaches of Eric de Marais to the, quote, New Empiricism, Lewis Mumford, Henry Russell Hitchcock, Siegfried Gideon and Walter Gropius to the, quote, new monumentality, Rainer Banham to the new brutalism, and the emerging formalist historicist school of thought characterised by Rowe. Rowe himself was a special kind of hybrid. Trained as an architect but not practicing, trained as an art historian but not a member of the guild, a theoretician without an explicit method, and a critic who published only rarely, he moved easily among all these areas, sustained by an extraordinary faculty of visual memory that allowed the recall of any space, plan, facade, or image he had ever encountered. As a critic, it was this complex faculty that drove his essays and accounted for their deeply lasting effect. Rowe was not one to openly disclose his intellectual sources, nor to pay homage to mentors and methodological predecessors. Each of his now iconic articles seems written out of whole cloth, the powerfully evocative rhetoric of experience and the authoritative assertion of ideas and their history masking a deep knowledge of the intellectual, theoretical, and cultural history of architecture, and permitting an easy flow of the argument between apparently direct visual experience and pertinent allusion. Nevertheless, cracks sometimes appeared in this hermetic facade. In a 1973 addendum to the 1947 essay The Mathematics of the Ideal Villa, Rowe acknowledged that his comparative method owed much to Wolfflin while admitting its limitations. Such a method, he wrote, was unable to, quote, deal with questions of iconography, was, quote, over symmetrical in its approach, and if protracted in its close analysis, likely to, quote, impose enormous strain upon both its consumer and producer. Nevertheless, he immediately went on to propose yet another comparison of, quote, approximate configurations, this time between those of Schinkel's Altes Museum and Le Corbusier's Palace of Assembly, Chandigarh, which he felt might lead to further comparisons with, quote, certain productions of Mies van der Rohe. For despite the faults of the comparative method and its status as, quote, painfully belonging to a period circa 1900, end quote, Rohe found that the merits of this Wolffian style of critical exercise lay in its primarily visual approach, making the minimum of pretense to erudition, the least possible number of references outside itself, and thence its ultimate accessibility. And in a characteristic expression of the mixture of irritation and boredom accompanying the arduous task of writing all this down, he added, quote, for those who are willing to accept the fatigue. This combination of the Wolffian comparative method and accessible visual analysis was, of course, what led to Rohe's popularity among practicing architects, and conversely, his uncertain position in the Guild of Orthodox Art Historians. There's a footnote and it says Colin Rohe was never a great lover of footnotes, apart from a couple of references to Francis Yates in his MA thesis for London University. All of the rest refer to historical treatises. More importantly, there were no acknowledgements of his advisor Rudolf Witkauer, either in the thesis or in the subsequent articles, Mathematics of the Ideal Villa and Mannerism and Modern Architecture, both of which were deeply dependent on his teacher's published works. It goes on and on, but anyway. The outlines of the Wolffian method were well known and even seen as outmoded by the 1940s, but for Rohe they provided a ready matrix by which to contrast and compare to set up pairs of characteristics and thence pairs of objects, all measured according to the principle of side-by-side slide projection in the lecture room, a method pioneered by Wolffian himself. It is probable that in referring to Wolffian, circa 1900, Rohe was thinking not of Renaissance and Baroque of 1888, not translated until 1964, but of the later Principles of Art History of 1915, first translated into English in 1939, and no doubt pervasive in the post-war teaching at the Courtauld. Wolffian's classic pairing of complementary opposites, linear slash painterly, plane slash recession, closed form versus open form, tectonic versus atectonic, multiplicity versus unity, absolute clarity versus relative clarity, appealed to those for whom the visual interpretation of a work was privileged over the iconographic or historical interpretation. Of these categories, perhaps the most important for Rohe was that of the development of the plane into recession. In Wolffian's schema, this was a process whereby the representation of pictorial space shifted from the combination of forms into a plane as a principle to a definitively recessional type of composition, a move that took place between the 15th and the 16th centuries, between the period that Wolffian called the Classic or High Renaissance and what he termed the Baroque. For Rohe's generation, this signified a shift between the High Renaissance and what was later understood as Mannerism, and Wolffian's characterization is immediately recognizable as such. Quote, In the former classic case, the will to the plane, which orders the picture in strata parallel to the picture plane, in the latter, Baroque or Mannerist, the inclination to withdraw the plane from the eye, to discount it and make it inapparent, while the forward and backward relations are emphasized and the spectator is compelled to co-relate in recession. End quote. Following the celebrated comparison of Palladian and Corbusian villas, the chain of Wolflinian style comparisons in Rowe's writing appeared endless. In Mannerism and Modern Architecture of 1950, where the method was outlined in the context of specific formal gestures along the lines of Wolflin's own principles. In Neoclassicism and Modern Architecture, 1 and 2, 1956-57, where the implications of, quote, further comparisons with the productions of Mies van der Rohe were fulfilled, and in Transparency, Literal and Phenomenal, 1 and 2, 1955-56, where the collaboration of Robert Slutsky, a visual theorist par excellence, Rohe outlined the experiential foundations of his analytical approach. This approach was to reach its finest exposition, however, in the analysis of the Monastery of La Tourette, the last article he wrote before leaving Cambridge for Cornell in 1962. And therein lay the problem. This was one of the very few of Rowe's articles to be devoted to a single building, with few comparative Wolflinian examples to deploy. In December 1960, Colin Rowe stayed for 3 days in the Dominican Monastery of La Tourette. The ostensible reason for the visit was to prepare a critical article for the publication of Le Corbusier's recently completed work for the Architectural Review. Returning to Cambridge for the Lent term, Rowe set about writing his piece, by all accounts, including his own, one of the more difficult he had attempted. The result was a long reflection or meditation on the potentials of a visual analytic that he had been developing since 1947 for practical experiential criticism. Significantly enough, he opened with a quotation from José Ortega y Gasset, an author whose newly translated works Rowe had consumed with a passion, this one from Meditations on Quixote. Ortega's first book, from 1914, published in English for the first time only in 1961 when Rowe was writing. Drawn from the second section of the preliminary meditation titled Depth and Surface, the quotation encapsulated the perception that the later historians of Mannerism had exploited to the full, that the dimension of depth, whether of space or time, whether visual or oral, always appears in one surface. For Rowe, this sense of a flat surface expanding into depth through what Ortega terms the foreshortening that condenses two moments of vision into a single plane, the fusion of a simple vision, of the material fact with the, quote, purely intellectual vision that constitutes the second virtual life of the surface, precisely summed up what he had been saying about Mannerism since 1950. And indeed, the first sentence of the essay joins his first Corbusian conundrum, the blank panel at Villa Schwab, with his more recent experience of the north side of the Church of La Tourette. The monastery is thus heralded as potentially Mannerist in visual and virtual content with one cavil, that while both the Villa Schwab and La Tourette present themselves at the first instance through these surfaces, motifs, quote, without high intrinsic interest, once absorbed, these cannot retain the eye's focus of attention. But there is a second preliminary, also intellectual visual exemplar. Here the focus is not on a surface with potential depth, but on the appearance of a building as a whole as approached by a visitor, the Acropolis as experienced by Le Corbusier, the landscape with the, quote, false right angles of the composition, the, quote, elements of the site that, quote, rise up like walls, powerful and cubic, quote, like the walls of a room. This all in order to initially deny the comparison to La Tourette, which is not a type of Parthenon, and with a farmhouse that is not a proper layer. The absent, the Piraeus and Mount Pentecostus, which in turn is denied by similarities in the patterns of organization that reinforce the comparison. Quote, compounding of frontal and three-quarter views. Quote, impacting of axial directions. Quote, tension between longitudinal and transverse movements. And above all, the site. The, quote, intersection of an architectonic by a topographical experience. Once made, the unravelling of these deceptively simple comparison takes up much of the rest of the essay. At this point, however, Rowe drops what Ortega would call, quote, purely intellectual visual comparisons for three pages in order to introduce the monastery as encountered by a casual visitor, the experience of the direct and simple visual effect. The hill has been climbed, not an acropolis, an archway penetrated, not the propylaea, and with a mansard pavilion on the left and a kitchen garden on the right. Two extremely everyday objects of the French provincial landscape, the visitor is confronted by a decisively unconventional phenomenon that is stripped of all pretense of an accommodating entry to a work of architecture, a, quote, vertical surface gashed by horizontal slots, an enigmatic plane bearing multiple scars like the injuries of time, with rising above its parapet a series of three gesticulating entrails to the initiated canons a lumière. The visitor feels immediately, quote, cold-shouldered by the building. Of course, this particular visitor, who had instantly transformed his preliminary visual experience into an intellectual one, only now was able to name this plane, this surface, literally as the wall of the north side of the church. But there appeared another ambiguity, for a frontally encountered wall is also evidently an elevation and generally a front. However, at La Tourette, this elevation was not a front facade, but a flank, a profile rather than a full face, noted Rowe, always one to equate facades and faces. The visitor is now plunged into an almost traumatic experience, as unexpected as it is painful, indicating even, quote, a presumable tragic insufficiency in his status, without the, quote, means of making coherent his own experience. He is made the subject of diametric excitations. His conscientiousness is divided. Such a condition is, as Rowe intends to intimate, akin to that attributed by Wolflin, then Alois Riegel, August Schmarsow, Max Dvorak and Pevsner to the Mannerist subject, which is compared so often in their writings to the anxious, alienated modern subject, and then linked indissolubly to the expression of anxiety in forms that seem self-contradictory, juxtaposed discordantly, the deliberate inversion of classical or modernist rules, or, quote, a state of inhibition, as Rowe called it, an attitude of dissent. An attitude that Le Corbusier shared, Rowe argued, with Palladio. Recovering himself and comfortably reverting to his intellectual vision, the visitor, rather than simply turning the corner to investigate the actual front, instead then set out to, quote, to cross an imaginary picture plane with the intent of discovering its frontal components. As if La Tourette might be ordered according to the rules of the literal and the phenomenal transparencies striating the League of Nations project. Here he was led one way by the oblique parapet and its false perspective, but also the other way by the opening up of the steep vistas overlooking the valley. At once the wall emerges as a pointer to, quote, a space rifted and ploughed up into almost unbridgeable chasms. The hill might then just be an acropolis. And the monastery a Parthenon? For despite all indications to the contrary, based on previous experience, when the corner is turned, quote, the anticipated frontal views never materialize. The only front is a side. For the rest, all other views are foreshortened and presented at a three-quarter angle. While other exposures, east and west, at the price of uncomfortable clambering around, may certainly be seen in frontal alignment, they are usually presented and apparently intended to be seen only in a rapid foreshortening. Which point of view, Rowe argued, was similar to that presented by Le Corbusier Choisy in the self-presentation of the Parthenon, a modified three-quarter view. And even as the blank panel of the Villa Schwab generates a fluctuation of meaning and value between positive and negative implications, so the north wall of La Tourette with its false perspective is twisting. Its twisting canons a lumière sets up a double spiral condition that is with some difficulty embedded in the flat surface of the plane itself, thus provoking a kind of visual, quote, hallucination, an optical illusion that offers the key to the interpretation of the entire building. In this way is set up the understanding of the strange selection of sight, its abrupt slope that seems perversely to counter the calm of a horizontal monastery type, the cubic cells that seem to counter the domino prototype, and this again countered by the megaron volume of the church, what Rowe refers to as, quote, the cross-fertilization of the megaron and sandwich concepts. It is this tension that leads Rowe back to his original Corbusian prototypes, Poissy a sandwich, Maison Citrohan a megaron, and to the conundrum of Garche that exploits the tension between the two, once again visually, through its two major facades, which act as, quote, planes which volatilize the reading of depth. If, however, the shadow of Wolflin, and by implication Regal, is present throughout this imbricated reading, another intellectual father figure has emerged since the first essays on the ideal villa and mannerism were composed, that of Panofsky, whose seminal essay, Gothic Architecture and Scholasticism, was first published in 1951. Initially delivered as a lecture at the Benedictine Foundation of St. Vincent's College, this text argued for the intellectual homology between the emergence of scholastic thought in the early 13th century and the emergence of late Gothic architecture. Quote, as the scholastic movement, prepared by Benedictine learning, was carried on and brought to fruition by the Dominicans and Franciscans, so did the Gothic style, prepared in Benedictine monasteries, achieve its culmination in the great city of churches. Panofsky was not, of course, implying a direct influence of text over architecture, but rather a common state of mind that informed the architects and clergy alike. A, quote, mental habit, similar to that ascribed by art historians to the architects, painters, and dramatists of the period they called Mannerist. A month after Rowe returned to Cambridge from the Dominican monastery of La Tourette, he delivered his lectures on the Gothic, in which he disavowed any literal communion between Gothic and scholastic thought. But it was certainly true that Rowe was fascinated by the parallels between scholastic periodization and that of Mannerism. It is in this context that we can understand his summation of Le Corbusier's architectural method as applied to the monastery. For Rowe, the dialectic employed as between building and site, and all the other seemingly contradictory statements in form, was quintessentially Dominican. Like rival protagonists of a debate who progressively contradict and clarify each other's meaning, in sum, a scholastic debate. Knotrose said that, quote, the architects set out deliberately to provide the plastic analogue of scholastic debate. Rather, quote, it was only that his state of mind and that of his clients were coincident in their astringent quality and that both parties were ironically aware of their common identity and difference. The intellectual integrity of the Dominican scholastics and that of their architect were able, as in the High Gothic moment, quote, to bring religious institutions and modern architecture into accord. As he wrote much later in 1996, his stay in the convent was, quote, an infinitely rewarding experience, and especially so because, forbidden to speak, the monks listened to long readings on, quote, aspects of French archaeology. Rowe, sensitive to the scholastic method, was entranced to hear the voice of the reader intone references to Viollet-le-Duc and the romantic writer Prosper Mérimée, thus confirming the survival of the 19th century in the 20th and allowing his mind to concentrate on architecture. So there's a footnote about Rowe. He says, as Rowe wrote in 1996 in the prologue to the republication of his extended essay on, quote, The Provocative Facade, 1987, quote, my 3 days at La Tourette were spent in thinking about its relation to Maison Domineau, Maison Citrohan, to Garche and to Poissy. And the side wall of Maison Citrohan, promoted to prominence, has obsessed me ever since. The parallels between Panofsky's understanding of scholastic architecture and his similar understanding of mannerist architecture, as evinced by his excursus to the essay, quote, the first page of Giorgio Vasari's Libro, where he explicates, in an uncanny replay of Rowe's comparison to the facades of the Casa Palladio and Le Corbusier's Chaux de Fonds, the mannerist qualities of Domenico Beccafumi's project for remodeling Casa di Borghese Siena were thus evident to Rowe, and in the essay on La Tourette, the two were finally brought together with a rhetorical confidence that would never again be repeated, at least in the exhaustive and, in Rowe's terms, exhausting extended writing on a single building. Perhaps it is impossible to recapture today a moment when history, theory, and criticism can be so integrally captured by an architectural sensibility. After the longue durée of self-conscious analytical approaches drawn from outside the discipline and the resulting fatigue with criticism, Rowe's slightly tendentious, often retardataire social attitudes seem in this context dated. But the conviction that a building is more than its physical status, that this very status might be unpacked to reveal that it is in fact a complex argument, both intellectually and culturally, and that this is the art of criticism to unravel this argument, might still, one hopes, hold its value in a world divided between the authority of facts and the powerful sway of opinion. I just think in all of this, no one has mentioned the monastery at Emma that Korb was supposedly in awe of and was situated on the top of a hill. So maybe in the next text on La Tourette by Pier Vittorio Maria, it will come up. Otherwise, I'll read that article as well.